Hello, my name is Tapio Maseba, and this is the Commercial Awareness Podcast, episode 64. First, some headlines. According to a survey of 2,000 companies conducted by the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development, one in three British businesses are planning job cuts in the third quarter as the furlough scheme winds down. In further retail woes, Marks & Spencer is to cut 7,000 jobs over the next 3 months and plan to accelerate digitization plans. But, in good news for retail, the Office for National Statistics has published results for July, where sale volume has actually surpassed pre-lockdown level, but online retail is 50% higher compared to before the lockdown, and clothing stores are slowly recovering after being the hardest hit during the pandemic, but are yet to reach pre-lockdown levels. In law firm updates, Mayor Brown is expecting to repopulate its London office next month at 50% capacity, still on a voluntary basis. Clifford Chance is also planning to reopen its London office early next month at limited capacity. Airbnb has submitted documents to go public, with Latham & Watkins as their advisors, and finally, with 1 in 10 adults in the UK using the scheme according to the ONS, the Eat Out to Help Out scheme has been a success. And some pub restaurant owners like Franco Manca owner Fulham Shore and pub group Green King have called for the scheme to be extended into September or risk site closure, while some groups like Gaucho and the City Pub Group have said they will continue 50% discounts with or without government help to keep demand up. If you'd like to read more on any of those stories, links as always are in the description. This week's format is one longer read. I know, we'll talk about TikTok in the next episode, I promise. But seriously, it's been a bit of a busy week, some stories are still developing before I'd like to talk about them, and the one longer read is so far-reaching, there is a little bit for everyone in it. So, without further ado, in today's longer read, and in an update to the demise of the gig economy bonus episode, Uber and Lyft have been told to reclassify their drivers in California as workers. But there's a twist. To start, let's briefly recap that episode, as it was a very long time ago, almost a year actually. The gig economy is, in basic English, a labor market or culture that depends on independent contractors or self-employed people doing short-term work or gigs. On one side, it brings flexibility of work for people who maybe don't want full-time work or work multiple jobs. On the other side, it has been seen by labor activists as exploitative of workers, as employers of gig workers don't need to give them sick pay, minimum wage, holiday leave, or any other right an employee would have. At this juncture, it's also important to differentiate gig workers from zero-hour contracts from a UK perspective. Both controversial, but not the same. Gig workers are paid per gig, like an Uber driver is paid per completed trip. Zero-hour workers are paid per hour, but aren't guaranteed a specific set of hours. Both result in income uncertainty, but zero-hour workers are entitled to holiday pay. So, that distinction aside, gig workers and the companies that promote gig work have been subject to much criticism, and regulatory bodies around the world have been trying to rein it in. That brings us to California and Assembly Bill 5, or AB 5. AB 5, nicknamed the Gig Worker Bill, is a law that would drastically change the dynamics of the gig economy. And by drastically change, I mean put an end to it if widely adopted. The law involves a three-pronged test, where a person would only be considered an independent contractor or gig worker if, 1, the worker is free to perform services without control or direction of the company, 2, the worker is performing work tasks that are outside the usual course of the company's work activities, and 3, the worker outside of the work they do for that company is customarily engaged in the same kind of work. So, let's use the test with Uber, shall we? 1. Is a driver free to perform services without control or direction of the company? Yeah, I'd say so. They don't have to use Uber to get passengers, but it definitely makes it easier. 2. is a driver performing tasks that are outside the company's usual work activities? Uber's chief legal officer didn't think so. Tony West said, quote, "Driver's work is outside the usual course of Uber's business, which is serving as a technology platform for several different types of digital marketplaces," end quote. And you know what? It was worth a shot, but that defense failed. Judges in California deem Uber a transport company, so drivers do not perform tasks outside of the company's usual work activities. So, drivers would already be classed as workers, but let's ask the third part of that test anyway. Is the worker engaged in the same kind of work when they are not doing it for the company? Yes and no. Some drivers are full-time private hire drivers, others aren't. Regardless, because of the second prong, Uber would have to class their drivers as workers and not independent contractors under AB 5. This would significantly increase staffing costs for the company and liability. If a driver committed wrongdoing, there's a chance Uber would be vicariously liable. If a driver was injured on the job, Uber would probably have to compensate them. Uber drivers would also be entitled to minimum wage, paid holiday, and health insurance in California. This law technically came into force at the start of the year, but Uber and Lyft have been fighting it since. They have also lobbied for a new law called Proposition 22, which would override AB 5 and classify app-based drivers as independent contractors. Californians will vote on whether Proposition 22 becomes law in November. But between now and November, California's Attorney General wanted Uber and Lyft to treat their drivers as workers and sued both companies for an injunction that would require them to do so, on top of hundreds of millions of dollars in unpaid wages for drivers who should have already been classified as workers. And on the 10th of August, a state judge ruled against Uber and Lyft and gave them 10 days to reclassify their drivers as workers. And here's the twist, Lyft, instead of rushing to change the employment status of their hundreds of thousands of drivers, announced that they'd be ceasing operations in California. Uber CEO said Uber would do the same on the 20th of August. Lyft added in their statement, quote, "This is not something we wanted to do. As we know, millions of Californians depend on Lyft for daily essential trips," end quote. And so, in response, on the 20th of August, day 10, the California Appeals Court stayed the injunction, now allowing Uber and Lyft until at least October to appeal the decision and fight to keep their drivers as independent contractors. Now, part of the court's conditions in staying the injunction requires the companies to provide plans of how they would reclassify their workers if Proposition 22 failed in November and if they lost their appeal. But Uber and Lyft gambled and won, at least for now, and that's a little frightening. Again, it's not uncommon that we have stories of regulation catching up to tech. But what happens when tech companies just refuse to comply and threaten to leave hundreds of thousands of workers without any kind of work because regulation wants them to have more protections? And we've kind of seen it in the UK as well, considering in episode 31, TfL revoked Uber's license to operate initially in 2017 as Uber was not, quote, fit and proper, end quote, to function, and technically lost the license again in 2019, and yet, in London, I can still call an Uber. And of course, this is because Uber has successfully been able to continue operating as it appeals, as it has in California, but does that mean it's still operating while it is allegedly not fit and proper to function? It definitely asks questions as to whether regulatory bodies can, especially right now during a global recession, afford to require companies to employ more people or change the dynamics of their employment, or is the risk of these companies pulling the rug from under thousands of temporary workers too high? And that seemed far-fetched a week ago, but Uber and Lyft pretty much played chicken and succeeded. It also asks questions about the gig economy discussion in the UK as well, and what this will result in. In 2017, Matthew Taylor, the chief executive of the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, submitted a review to the UK government created, quote, "to consider how employment practices need to change in order to keep pace with modern business models," end quote. The report made a number of recommendations for the future of work. For our purposes, it recommended that, and this is a long quote, quote, platform-based working offers welcome opportunities for genuine two-way flexibility and can provide opportunities for those who may not be able to work in more conventional ways. These should be protected while ensuring fairness for those who work through these platforms and those who compete with them. We should be clearer about how to distinguish workers from those who are legitimately self-employed. End quote. Further, it also recommended, quote, the best way to achieve better work is not national regulation, but responsible corporate governance, good management, and strong employment relations within the organization, which is why it is important that companies are seen to take good work seriously and are open about their practices, and that all workers are able to be engaged and heard. End quote. In 2018, and in response to the Taylor Review, the UK government published the Good Work Plan, which suggested some changes to the gig economy. One of the changes would be the right to request a more stable and predictable contract for workers. To illustrate what this means, say you're working a zero-hour contract at Sports Direct or you're a rider for Deliveroo. If you on average work 30 hours a week for at least 6 months, you should be able to request a 30-hour-a-week contract. The key word is request. You can request it, they can say no. They will probably say no. But hey, like the Taylor Review said, you'll be, quote, engaged and heard, end quote. So in substance, there's no real legislation to make mention of that has drastically changed the gig economy in the UK. Partly because the Taylor Review recommended it be left to companies to govern themselves well and those who work for them, or don't work for them because they're technically independent contractors. However, there's a similar battle that's made its way to the Supreme Court. The Employment Tribunal in London and the Court of Appeal have previously declared that Uber drivers in London are workers and not independent contractors, and now it is up to the Supreme Court to decide. Uber's defense has always been that it's technically a technology company, not a transport business, and, if anything more, it's just an intermediary between drivers and passengers. This is an argument both the Employment Tribunal and Court of Appeal have dismissed. The judgments have said that because of Uber's degree of control over drivers, such as suggesting trips to take and rating systems, Uber is not just a platform playing as intermediary between drivers and passengers, but instead employer of workers when drivers have the app on. This definition of worker would give drivers a right to minimum wage, holiday pay, and more health and safety obligations on Uber's part. It's also worth mentioning, just for context, that Uber's terms of use would have already tried to claim that they're merely a platform, and a driver is an independent contractor, with each passenger as a client to the driver. However, the majority in the Court of Appeal and Employment Tribunal alike relied on a Supreme Court decision called AutoCleanse, that is AutoClenz. They argued, quote, the effect of AutoCleanse in our view is that, in determining for the purposes of Section 230 of the ERA 1996, what is the true nature of the relationship between the employer and the individual who alleges he is a worker or an employee, the court may disregard the terms of any documents generated by the employer which do not reflect the reality of what is occurring on the ground, end quote. This would effectively give courts discretion to look past legal documents and instead decide worker status based on fact. Lord Underhill, dissenting in the Court of Appeal, said, quote, AutoCleanse does not permit the rewriting of agreements only because they are disadvantageous. Protecting against abuses of inequality of bargaining power is the role of the legislation, end quote. It's worth reminding you, per the Taylor Review, it has been recommended that legislation not govern the gig economy. So, this dissenting view will probably be something Uber will depend on in the Supreme Court. As evidence was heard just last month, there is yet to be a decision, but that decision could ultimately follow the Employment Tribunal and Court of Appeal, glance over the Taylor Review's recommendations, and result in a drastic change in the dynamic of app-based gig workers. But, to bring it back to Uber and Lyft in California, what then happens to the 45,000 Uber drivers in London alone if Uber decides to just cut their losses and cease operations? How much leverage do these companies really have? And how much are they willing to risk? And with all that said, what do you think about it all? It really is tricky. It's clear that there is a fair number of app-based gig workers who don't want to be classed as self-employed, but equally, there is some truth to be said about the Taylor Review's observation that gig roles can at times provide two-way flexibility. I think of Deliveroo, for example. Anecdotally, I've had friends in university who have delivered through Deliveroo whenever they felt like it. Being employed and therefore being given rigid schedules would guarantee income, but would do away with the flexibility they would have initially wanted when they signed up. And Deliveroo aside, Uber has been seen as competition much to the chagrin of taxi drivers and minicabs. And yet, as observed by Lord Underhill, taxi drivers and minicab drivers are considered self-employed, so would this then be an overcorrection? And if so, what is the solution? New York is a potential model, where app-based drivers are given a minimum wage, though this comes attached with no other benefits. And it appears that Uber and Lyft want similar leeway in California, as Proposition 22 provides some protections, but not as many as a worker. So how should the gig economy be reined in, and should it be? It's worth remembering that through all of this, independent contractors still exist beyond tech. A self-employed plumber, for example, wouldn't want to be employed by every household they did work in. You can offer a tradesperson a cuppa when they perform a service, but I don't think they expect holiday pay from you. But if a tradesperson used a platform to find work, should that platform then be called its employer? And what about the gig economy in law? Platforms like FLEX connect gig work lawyers or flex lawyers to firms for short-term paralegal work when there is high demand. Is the platform now your employer? For these reasons, the gig economy and how it is governed around the world could have far-reaching implications beyond just Uber. We could see changes in employment law, corporate liability, transport law, contract law, and freedom of contract considering auto cleanse. And in the legal field when we consider the new age of on-demand paralegals. But because of Uber and Lyft's gamble in California, in comes another factor. What if these platforms just up and left in retaliation or threatened to? Again, it's something I hadn't even considered until it happened a few days ago, but that just highlights the unique times we're currently living in. For that reason, it's worth your time to keep an eye on Uber BV and others v. Aslam, especially if the judges distinguish when and when not to use the auto-cleanse principle. The Supreme Court link is in the description. So, this story has really taken us from California to New York to London, from transport to the legal field. And this really gives you a lot of leeway in how to talk about this story and what to focus on, depending on what firm you're talking to. If it's a tech-focused firm, the questions as to the liability for future tech companies should probably take center stage. Is Uber's defense that it's a tech company first, not a transport company, valid? What about its defense that it's merely an intermediary, and every driver contracts with a passenger as an independent contractor? If it's a transport-focused firm, the latter question would apply as well. If employment-focused, depending on whether they represent individuals or companies, the Taylor Review, the Good Work Plan, and the case should take center stage. Should Uber drivers be treated as workers or independent contractors? How do you feel about the gig economy as a whole? Basically, is it good or bad? And for any and all firms, the contract law angle is worth considering. Is it a court's role to overstep freedom of contract if the contract factually doesn't reflect the reality of the relationship? And if you happen to know whether or not the firm you're interested in has ever used gig lawyer platforms or flex lawyers, the Supreme Court decision could be a precursor for a change in obligations between themselves, the platform, and the gig lawyer. So, to close, the most basic of questions, there will probably be a poll question this week on the podcast Instagram page at ComawarePod, that is ComawarePod. Is the gig economy exploitative or merely a modern take on employment? Credit for this story goes to California Legislature, the UK government, the Taylor Review of Modern Working Practices, the Court of Appeal, the Supreme Court, Joel Rosenblatt, Quinn Topham, Andrew J. Hopkins, Dave Lee, Megan Rose Dickey, and Rachel Sandler. This has been the Commercial Awareness Podcast. Please be sure to follow, subscribe, and rate the podcast on your listening platform. It goes a long way. Also, recommend it to a friend. If you need to contact me, the podcast email address is on the first line of the episode description, and the podcast Instagram page is at ComAwarePod, that is ComAwarePod, if you prefer to contact me there or just want to follow the podcast there for any updates. The podcast Instagram page is also a way to interact with the podcast where you can participate in polls to reflect on past episodes and suggest topics for future episodes. Other than that, thank you for listening, and you'll hear from me next week.